Hello, it's Peter and Kathleen with another episode of The Yakking Show. And we're bringing you another episode in the Harmony, Your Path to Wholeness channel with an expert to help you improve your life. I have to warn you that this episode may contain some sensitive information. So just a warning that if you're easily offended, there might be something coming up that you we'll have to think about, but we don't go out of our way to offend people. We try and bring people helpful information. But first, let's introduce co-host Kathleen. Hi, Kathleen. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Peter. Thank you. And thank you all so very much for tuning in to our show. We so appreciate having you. And as Peter mentioned, we do have another special guest with us today. We are very privileged to welcome Dr. Stephen Davidson to the show. Hello, Dr. Davidson. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you very much.
Now, Dr. Davidson is a clinical sexologist and a clinical social worker. He specializes in treating sexual problems, and he's also a published author. So let's just jump right in, Dr. Davidson. What is the biggest issue preventing people from having fulfilling sexual relationships?
I think the biggest issue that gets in the way for individuals who are dating, pursuing relationships, and also for couples with established relationships is shame. And that might sound surprising that someone could be partnered, could be married, and still dealing with shame in their life. But I see that repeatedly in my work with individuals and couples. That shame could be shame about their bodies. It could be shame about their erotic desire, the things that they fantasize about, or the things that they find erotically appealing. And it's a common barrier to why couples have so much difficulty communicating about their sexual relationship.
Ah, that is interesting, but yeah, it makes a lot of sense when you start thinking about that. So, slightly different type of question. How important is it to overall well-being to have a good sexual relationship? And conversely, can you have a good relationship without sex?
Well, I have had that question before, and my response always is that yes, you can have good relationships with the neighbors, with your friends, with your coworkers. None of those are sexual relationships, but they might be good relationships and meaningful and fulfilling life. But in a partnership or a social relationship, a romantic relationship, we generally expect that sex is going to be part of that. And certainly, if our expectation is that the relationship is going to be monogamous, this is the only person with whom we can have sexual expression and sexual fulfillment. So it's very important that in that primary romantic relationship, spousal relationship, that the couple is sexually compatible and able to have communication with each other about their needs for sex and also for intimacy, because those are two very different concepts.
Yes. Okay.
So, having said that, though, as couples age, it seems that sexual desire often declines. Is there anything that can be done about that?
You're correct. It does decline, and there's been lots of research done on this. We know that this is the case for couples, that sexual activity becomes less frequent the longer the couple is together. And when we're figuring out what we're going to do about it, we have to figure out why that's happening. And it's a natural process as couples tend to nest that the relationship starts to focus on other things. Certainly, if they have children, a lot of their energy is focused on raising their children. But it can also be focused on things like their individual careers, building a home together, their time with extended family. But there may be other factors that are influencing the decline in sexual activity. And that could be medical issues. Maybe there are health issues. We know that as we age, both men and women have changes in hormone levels that influence our libido. Some medical issues can cause a change in sexual appetite. Some medications that you take to treat medical problems can influence our sex drive and our sexual performance. So it could be medical. It could be psychological. Things like anxiety or depression have a negative influence on libido. Or it could be relational. And so in that relationship, there may have been deception, betrayal. As the relationship evolves, there's less trust, there's less respect. You might not like the person as time passes as much as you liked them initially. And all of those things will influence the frequency of sexual activity.
If a couple, oh, I'm sorry, Peter.
No, carry on.
If a couple has made, not necessarily made the decision, but they've just, you know, they're not having sex as regularly as they used to. I think society makes it them feel sometimes that this is abnormal and that, you know, but it's not, right? I mean, it's, is it? I mean,
Yeah, I define sex very broadly, and a lot of people think that sex is just about having intercourse. And that's how most couples think about sex, but there's lots of ways that you can be with another person, be with your partner that can be physically pleasurable. And as we age, intercourse might not always be an option for us just because of changes in the body. But there are ways that we can still have physical touch with our partners and still want to have that kind of physical connection. And sometimes people give that up if intercourse is no longer an option for them, for whatever the reason might be. So I spent a lot of time trying to broaden people's mind about how they think about sexuality and sexual activity, and that we might still desire to have physical contact with another person, even if there are medical or psychological barriers to being able to have intercourse.
That leads me on to what I was going to ask you, but something that when you were talking about reasons why people can't indulge in sexual relations, another one is complications from certain surgical procedures, right? I mean, I know of women who've had hysterectomies that have left them where any intercourse is either very painful or sometimes almost impossible, right? So that's another complication that has to be addressed. But I'm very glad of what you just said about intimacy. That was going to be my question. Do you find in your experience that when a couple stops having intercourse for any of the reasons you've mentioned, that intimacy goes out the window as well, or not
Well,
necessarily?
I think of intimacy as being more of an emotional connection to the other person. And certainly we can facilitate that connection through sexual activity or through physical touch. But
Touch, right.
sometimes this is another factor regarding shame. People have shame that as they have aged, their bodies don't perform the way they used to. They have shame about their difficulties with things like arousal. So this is why it's so important that people overcome their shame and be open to communication with their partners so that as life evolves, as the relationship evolves, we can talk about how we're going to navigate this. And we don't get stuck in a mindset that our relationship has to be the way it was when we were in our 20s,
Right.
because in our 50s and beyond, it's going to be very different.
Sure.
And couples need to expect that and talk about it, find ways to navigate it, but not just shut it down. So sometimes people just stop altogether because they still have that 20-year-old mindset.
Makes sense. So I've got to ask you, in your experience, do you find that the younger generations are better about talking about it and preventing these problems arising than my boomer generation. Are we seeing an improvement in communication?
That's a great question. Even with younger people, I really struggle to get them to talk to each other. So they know a lot more about sexuality because they've been exposed to a lot
Sure.
more information, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they know how to have conversation. In fact, they might not even be as good at conversation about it and problem solving as our generation.
Really, that's interesting. That is
Because
interesting.
they communicate more in sound bites, texting, very brief communication. They are used to social media interaction with communication. The face-to-face sitting down and talking to someone, problem solving, being able to navigate conflict. I don't know that they are any better at that than our generation is.
Interesting. That's very interesting. Yeah.
So, Dr. Davidson, can you tell us how, tell us about your services, the services you provide, and please tell us about your books.
Yes, I'm a clinical sexologist. I'm licensed in Florida and also Tennessee. I see both couples and individuals. My practice is really a general practice because while sex therapy is my specialization, I've also treated people for depression, anxiety, other kinds of psychological issues. I see couples who are dealing with conflict that's not sexual in nature. And so I teach problem-solving skills and conflict resolution skills. And I work with people in my office or virtually. I have a few clients that I provide coaching services to who are not in Tennessee or Florida. And coaching is a little different from psychotherapy or sex therapy because it's more focused on education and skill building, very future oriented. There doesn't necessarily have to be a diagnosis that we are treating with that. I have a YouTube channel at Sexual Integrity Coach, YouTube at Sexual Integrity Coach, where I do a weekly sex education video. It's 10 to 15 minutes, and I talk about a variety of sex education topics. And I'm really letting the subscribers to that channel drive the topics that I discuss. So some of them are more common than others, but people message me and say, I'd like to learn more about this. Would you tell me more about it? Or would you tell me how I could find information about that? And I developed a YouTube channel after my first book, Sexual Integrity, Finding Courage to Be Yourself. And sexual integrity is a phrase that I use to coach people to just be themselves. We're all different sexual beings. We don't have the same desires. Our bodies are different. Our backgrounds are different. Our sexual needs are different. And if we show up in relationships and we're not completely authentic and we're not living from a place of integrity, then we're not going to be honest from the beginning of that relationship about who we are. And down the road, there will be problems because we didn't really begin that relationship from a place of integrity. So the book contains some scenarios of different individuals and couples who struggled with that in their relationship and how they overcame it so that they could be a little more true to themselves and their partners.
And how do
Wow.
people get your books?
There's a link on my website. The website is sexualintegritycoach.com. But the book is available on Amazon, Audible, Kindle, and bookstores. So, it's out there for wide distribution.
Perfect. Okay, that's great. We'll put the links in the description, in the show notes, and in our newsletter as well. Here's one for you, slightly different tack we're going on now. And I'm an old guy, as I said, I'm a boomer. So in my opinion, of one. It seems to me that many more men are identifying themselves as homosexual as the years go by. Is this societal pressure, or is it natural inclination? Is it both, or is it just that society is becoming more tolerant about hearing about it? I don't know the answer to that. Do you have an opinion on that?
Yeah, and there's actually been lots of research on that. So, what we're not really seeing an increase in what we would consider the rate of
Okay.
same-sex attraction. What we're seeing is people are more honest about it
Okay.
now. So people are living again a little more authentically, more from a place of integrity about who they are as sexual beings.
Okay.
It might appear that there's an increase because we see it in the media more often. So we see gay individuals, men and women, represented in television programs, movies, commercials. A lot more celebrities are open about their sexual orientation. And so it appears that it's increasing. But it's very different from what we saw in the 50s and 60s, where so many people were living in the closet or they were living a double life. It's one of the reasons that I used the mask on the cover of my book, because there are all kinds of ways that people live a double life. I hear stories sometimes of individuals who have two different families. And they discovered that their father also had children, in a neighboring town, and they didn't know anything about it until they were growing up. And I'm a baby boomer myself, so I know that our generation and the few previous generations had lots of secrets that they kept, and there were things that just were not discussed or talked about.
I remember a case from my childhood where my father picked up very quickly that a certain man was probably homosexual. And I overheard him telling my mother, "Don't you ever let those boys, myself and my brother, go to that house on their own. Don't let them go without you." But this guy was married with kids, so I could not understand how he could possibly be anything to worry about. And of course, that's what you were just talking about. In that era, the double life was very common, right? That many men who were homosexual married women and had families because that was what society expected, and the rest of the other part of their life was hidden away. So yeah, I hear what you're saying.
Right. And also at that time, people confused homosexuality with pedophilia. And, there's no, most people who identify as same-sex attracted are not pedophiles. So they're not sexually attracted to children. They are adult attracted.
Oh,
But
yes, sure.
that was a common misconception, in the 50s, most
Yeah.
definitely.
And that was the background to my father's comment about not letting us be exposed to this guy, because I think that was his real fear. Yeah, you're right. You're right. And I think on that same vein, many pedophiles also have other sex relationships as well. They're not exclusively homosexual, are they?
That's correct. With pedophilia, and I know we're going off on a different topic now that maybe you didn't intend to discuss, but with pedophilia, we're talking about people who are attracted to prepubescent children, male or female. They can be male attracted, female attracted, or attracted to both. But a lot of people with pedophilia are in marriages. And so it's we've been warned about the stranger in the dark alley, but it's never the stranger in the dark alley. It's the person who lives next door. It's the school teacher. It's an uncle. It's someone that who has easy access to that child, because there is a grooming process that's involved in setting up the abuse.
Sorry, my internet is giving me trouble. I live on a farm, and my internet sometimes blips a little bit. So, Kathleen, you carry on.
So this next question, Dr. Davidson, we know that there's a woke agenda out now, and people are told to accept any sexual preferences as normal, but and any criticism is really taboo these days. You really can't have this discussion, but I wonder how much is actually normal. I know some transgender people that feel that they were born, say, in the wrong body. Does that imply that they were born with a birth defect?
I think that would be debatable. I would say no to that.
Okay.
Gender is something that we've really started talking about more seriously in the last 20 years. And it's interesting that there is so much resistance to understanding it, exploring it, being able to talk about it more openly. People who today identify as transgender have always existed throughout world history and in every culture. We haven't always used the same terminology to understand it. We're talking about being baby boomers. There are people that we used to call women we used to call tomboys. And you don't hear that term very much anymore, but it was a girl who liked sports and liked to climb trees, and maybe she wanted to wear overalls, and she didn't like frilly dresses and tea parties. But throughout world history, we see people who have varying gender presentations, and every culture finds a way to deal with that in that particular time in history. So I'm hoping that we get more comfortable talking about sexuality in all its presentations and all its forms. And certainly this subject of gender, because gender is, and how we perceive gender has been used historically in discrimination, certainly against women. It's been in my lifetime that women didn't have access to birth control. In many states in the US in 1960. It wasn't until 1972 that women in every state in the US won the right to have access to birth control. It wasn't until the 70s that women were allowed to have credit in their own name. Their husband or their father had to sign for them to be able to have credit. And so we've used gender as a way to limit people's access to resources, to limit their access to employment, to housing, all kinds of things. And I think the subject of being non-binary or transgender is one more area that we've got to figure out so that we're not leaving people behind.
But there was a big difference in the era we grew up in, and I hear what you're saying. I mean, my own wife rode horses, she climbed trees, she didn't like, still doesn't to this day in her 70s, doesn't like frilly dresses. And she said, I went through that phase where it was fun to be a boy until I was about 12 or 13. Then I realized I was a girl after all, and I didn't suffer from it. So, and I've known boys who are quite effeminate and like ballet and that sort of thing. But in our era, there was no societal pressure or pressure in schools to convince those children who were more comfortable playing a girl or boy role that they should go and have surgery or puberty blockers. There was no pressure whatsoever. My fear is that some children are being coerced into this, and that's not going to be their long-term natural inclination. Is that a legitimate fear of mine, or do you think it's under control?
I don't think it's a legitimate fear. I don't know if this is where people are being coerced. That certainly would not be ethical.
Not sure.
As a psychotherapist, a sex therapist, a healthcare provider, that's contradictory to our ethics to coerce people to do anything like that. So I think what is happening is people are having more discussions about gender roles, gender behavior, and what is psychologically best for a child who might perceive themselves as transgender. So I've worked with, I don't work with children or adolescents. I only work with adults. But I've worked with transgender adults, both trans men and trans women, who all of their life, from real early in childhood, they never felt like they were living congruently with their assigned sex at birth. They always felt like they should have been the other gender. And so
Well,
for them, it wasn't.
and that's why my question about, well, does that mean like I called it a birth defect, maybe a birth abnormality, but if that's how they feel, you wouldn't consider that something abnormal?
We don't consider it abnormal at this time. So certainly it's been considered abnormal in the past, but we, the World Health Organization, the American Psychiatric Association, is increasingly trying to be more respectful of various forms of sexual expression and to not just label people as deviants or as mentally ill, because they can function very well in every other area of life. And they're finding ways to navigate this area of life in their gender expression by, if they want to have gender reassignment surgery, or by presenting themselves publicly as the, as transgender. So in my profession, we don't look at this as this is a horrible thing or this is something we've got to shut down. We really want to try to support people and help them to be authentic with their sexuality. And that's why I wrote the book, to live with an integrity, because I think a lot of people, I think people have lied a lot in the past because that's what everybody around them was comfortable with. Sometimes, in some situations, it was a means of survival to hide the truth. And so we don't want people to do that. It's psychologically not helpful, it's psychologically destructive, and it impairs our ability to continue to learn and study and, get more answers to some of the difficult questions that you're asking.
Interesting one. If one studies biology and evolution, I would guess that the percentage of people who don't want to perform their assigned or the sexual roles they were born in has to be self-limiting. Otherwise, the human race would be extinct. At some point, there would not be enough babies produced if that rate, if that percentage of people like that increases. So, am I right in thinking biology and evolution will limit that to a certain extent? I don't know what that might be, but it has to be self-limiting, surely.
Well, currently the number of people who identify as transgender is between 1% and 2%. So we're talking about a really small percentage of people here. And here in the US, we have so many other bigger problems that need to be addressed that are affecting all of us and certainly children, like, gun laws here in the States where children are being murdered every day. Either in their home or in neighborhoods or in school settings, they are far more at risk of dying at the hands of a gun than they are at dying from someone who's transgender.
Oh, sure. No, I'm not arguing that at all.
And so we have to keep those things in perspective. I'll also remind you that about almost 2% of births every year are considered to be intersex. Are you familiar with that concept?
As many as that, 2%.
How did, what was the term? Intersex?
Intersex. They've also been at other times in history, it might have been referred to as disorders of sexual development.
Oh, okay.
These are individuals who don't have clearly defined genitalia,
Oh,
or
okay.
Maybe it's not completely evident at the time of birth, whether they are biologically male or biologically female. And so historically, there have been surgeries done on infants and children to try to adapt them and make them be either one gender or the other. Those surgeries have not had good outcomes. And so there's an organization called Interact, which is an advocate organization for children and youth. So to advocate that they are not subjected to these surgeries to try to change their bodies or alter their bodies in a way that is inconsistent with who we're not fully going to know who they are until they're in puberty or in adulthood. But Klinefelter syndrome is and Turner syndrome. These are two examples of situations where people would be considered intersex.
Wow, that's interesting.
And so, because of things like this, we know that it's not cut and dry. Biology is not cut and dry. It sometimes takes different turns and directions, and we want to understand that scientifically, and we want to help people and support people, as opposed to just shaming people for how they are divergent in their sexual expression or their biology.
That interesting and very, very interesting. Here's one that's always made me wonder: is the percentage of people who are sexually attracted to the same sex greater in men and women, or vice versa, or much the same?
Well, women tend to be more fluid with sexuality than men. And society is more comfortable with same-sex behavior between women than it is men. But generally, we tend to see more men who identify as gay than women who identify as lesbian. We're likely to see more women identify as bisexual than men identify as bisexual.
Oh, interesting. So,
Yeah, it is.
Dr. Davidson, what is the attraction to various sexual deviations such as S&M or paraphilia in general?
Yeah, paraphilia is a clinical term, and there are various kinds of paraphilias. But it includes mostly things that we casually refer to as kinks or fetishes. And I think paraphilias are fascinating because they often don't include any genital stimulation at all. It's interesting that we even consider it sexual activity because often there's no sexual stimulation that's happening. But sex, all aspects of our sexuality happens from the neck up. We think it happens from the waist down, but it doesn't. Everything that turns you on, turns you off, repulses you, excites you. It's all happening in the brain. All of the pleasure sensations that we have in our body that facilitate arousal and facilitate orgasm, all that's originating in the brain. And so a lot of our sexual activity includes things that are around desire, attraction, some aspects of power. And that's ne not necessarily abuse of power, but some people really enjoy the experience of being more in control in a sexual situation. Some people enjoy the experience of being more submissive in a sexual situation. And, there are things that we can find erotic, like lingerie, for example. Fredericks of Hollywood, Victoria's Secret, they built their entire brand around people's kinks and fetishes. But we look at that and we tend to normalize it because we say, oh, well, lingerie is okay. But there are other aspects of it that we might be less comfortable with. And so it's just about objects and scenarios, situations that people find erotic, sexually arousing. And a lot of those show up in romance novels and movies and different kinds of erotic literature that we tend to normalize and be quite comfortable with.
Interesting, interesting. So I got to ask you a quick follow on for that. I go to the church I go to has detected a problem that many men get addicted to pornography, more so than women, right? And so much so that it harms what on the outside appears to be a fairly normal, stable marital relationship and has repercussions on family. Is that quite prevalent, a male addiction to pornography, and does it signify a deeper problem? So there's two questions there, but it's something that's often intrigued me.
Well, the whole concept of pornography addiction is something that we've only been talking about since the dawn of the internet, since live streaming was available and you could have access to it so quickly. So, we'll go back to the fact that we're baby boomers, and when I was growing up, if I was going to have access to porn, I was going to have to find a magazine somewhere. And it was going to be one still picture, and you had to look at that picture for at least 30 days until the next magazine came out, if you could even get your hands on another magazine. And so it wasn't even possible to even consider this an addiction
No.
because you just couldn't use it that frequently. You didn't have a lot of access to it. The American Psychiatric Association does not acknowledge pornography addiction as a real addiction, because we're naturally wired to find erotic images arousing, sexually arousing. And so it has become a compulsion for many people because they can have such quick access to it. And the male brain especially is wired to enjoy looking at erotic situations. Throughout human history, there's lots of erotic art, sculpture, paintings. We see it on cave walls. We see it in ancient art. So humans have always been fascinated with these erotic images. But now, because of the internet, they can come at us very quickly. They're very accessible. It's easier to hide, and it's easier for people to have access to. It's another reason that I say couples need to be talking about their sexual relationship and not just let it shut down. Men will turn to pornography if they cannot have an open and honest discussion with their partner or their spouse about their sexual desires, their sexual appetite. And porn addiction, it's not something we really talk about for women very much. I don't know of any woman who's ever described herself in that way, but we know that women also look at pornography. They just don't use it in the same ways that men do.
No, thank you for that. Very good explanation. And you're absolutely right that in the area we grew up, it was the odd magazine, and then there was 8mm movie, 8mm cine film. But the shame, I grew up in Southern Africa in a British oriented culture, which was very conservative, and it was a jailable offense to be caught with an 8mm pornographic movie. So it was very, very much underground. I think I only ever got a glimpse of one in my whole life. So yeah, different era. But a good answer. Thank you for that, Dr. Davidson. My last question for you, one that we ask all our experts, is for our listeners who may be struggling with their sexual relationships, with any relationship, with life in general, what's one tip you could suggest to them to get on the path to sorting their lives out? Is there one thing they should look at right now?
Well, if they are in a relationship with their spouse or a partner, maybe they're living with a partner or they have a partner that they live separately from, I advocate for transparency and honesty to start there in your relationship. It's why I said I really want couples to begin their relationships from a place of being very transparent and honest about who they are as sexual beings. And the relationship needs to be one where people have permission to be honest and it's safe to be honest throughout the duration of the relationship. I have five questions in the back of the book here that I ask people to answer to determine if they have sexual integrity. And some of those questions revolve around just how safe they feel being honest with their partner about their thoughts, their fantasies, their desires, their sexual needs. So I would say a place to begin is to begin from being honest and transparent with that primary person in your life that's your sexual partner.
Oh, very good answer. Thank you. And a very, very valuable answer for people to think about. Thank you for that. And my last thing for our audience, you've had the experience of another brilliant guest. I've certainly learned a lot in this episode, which I really appreciate, Dr. Davidson. So thank you for sharing that with us. To our audience, if you don't want to miss out on our future guests, sign up for our newsletter. Go to theyakingshow.com. We only send you one email a week, but at least then you'll know who's on this week and who's coming next week. That's it from me. Thanks again, Dr. Davidson. Goodbye to everyone. Thanks for watching and listening. Back to Kathleen.
Well, Dr. Davidson, for one more time, can you tell people how they can contact you?
Yes, my website, which is sexualintegritycoach.com. It also has links to me on Facebook, LinkedIn, my YouTube channel. So it would be a way that you could, my email, it would be a way that you could find me in general. So just one link,
Okay.
sexualintegritycoach.com. Great.
Wonderful. Thank you. That was such an interesting chat. Thank you so much for being on our show today. We so appreciated having you. And once again, thank you all so very much for tuning in to our show. If anyone is interested in being a guest on our show, we invite you to visit us at theyakingshow.com. All you need to do is click on the Contacts tab where you will find a short application form, and we would love to hear from you. So until next time, take care, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.